ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Zach Edwards, a digital strategist with over a decade of experience, who got a start working on the new media team for Obama's first presidential campaign. Since then, Zach has worked on many political campaigns, product launches, in web development, and ad purchasing. He's also founded six companies, led the digital strategy for several New York Times best-selling book campaigns, and two documentary film launches. Zach, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Gabriella. I'm so happy to be here.
So you have a really interesting idea about how to change advertising, disrupt monopolies, provide new revenue for publishers. But before we dive into the nitty-gritty, which is super amazing, but also a bit complicated, I want you to give listeners the view from 50,000 feet about your career and how it developed over time so people understand the origins and basis and legitimacy for your idea.
Definitely. And thank you so much for that intro. My career, I've been a digital strategist for about 11 years, but before that, I was a professional poker player. And so sometimes when I'm describing the advertising concepts and game theory or markets, I reference poker. And the last 11 years, I've been doing a mix of political and advocacy work and then for-profit work. And I got started on President Obama's digital team, working for 15 months. I directed and co-directed digital operations in five of the primary states. Before that election was even over, I had agreed to support Mayor Bloomberg's re-election in New York. And by 2010, I had directed new media for a couple congressional and gubernatorial campaigns and stepped in to run the digital operations for Houston Mayor Bill White's gubernatorial campaign. And in politics, when I was doing these campaigns, we would have very large budgets. So raising tens of millions of dollars, and you have to spend all of it before a certain date. And so we would spend $15,000 a day, $20,000 a day, ramping up as fast as you possibly can, where there was no ROI except the votes on election day.
Right.
So I got a really interesting perspective on ad tracking when the strategy is, let's see how big this fire can get online as fast as possible, and we'll just see what happens on election day. And so I came out of sort of some of these political campaigns with an awareness that obviously that's not the way businesses can operate. And so I started to really talk about attribution, talk about advertising tracking, optimization, testing. And I fortunately, one of my early clients around 2012 was healthcare.com. And this was before the Priceline Group CEO kind of stepped in and acquired it. But I basically was able to work with a very large website that was spending millions of dollars in ads. It's a for-profit entity, and they basically need to arbitrage their traffic, help people find health insurance plans, and there's a lot of complicated data that moves around in a system like that. And so I really got my hands dirty pretty early, about six years ago, with Google Tag Manager, JavaScript, Google Analytics, some of the more complicated analytics and advertising concepts. So since that time, I've basically been setting up enterprise analytics tools. I've been helping people optimize their ads. I've done a lot of e-commerce tracking and people who have session breaking or e-commerce data holes. I've started to develop an expertise in identifying data that's not there and then creating and architecting the analytics SDKs for mobile apps and JavaScript snippets and the event layers and some really complicated technical things that just sort of tie together the creative and business sides of a website.
Right. So you've worked with for-profit, you've worked for nonprofit, I guess, advocacy, you know, selling audiences, products, things like that. So top line, what are the core strategies if you could bucket them into the major buckets, as far as buying and selling audiences, how would you categorize them?
That's a great question. And I think of it just as new and existing. So every business has existing customers and every business needs to find new customers. So if you take your business and just think of it into those two buckets, it really simplifies all the strategies. And what you're trying to do with the new audiences is find how you got the existing audiences, what converted them, and then basically create lookalikes or expansion audiences by tapping into Facebook, Google, the various tools out there to expand, buy new audiences, find new targeting options. And so I help a lot of businesses for understanding your existing customers. You have to set up analytics structures. You have to be reading the data. You have to be appending data to your current folks to know who they are, how they found out about you, what made them want to become your customer. And once you have that underlying understanding of the existing customers, you can then apply that into scaling it to new audiences.
Right. So because you work not just within one company, you see how many different enterprises are tackling this problem. Is there any sort of aha moment or insight or gap that you've seen because you are able to look at the innards of all these different companies?
Definitely. The unfortunate reality is this is all very complicated. And a good example is someone like the New Yorker. So it's a really great publisher, lots of great articles and content on there, and they're trying to figure out how to make profit. And so if a user goes to the New Yorker, it will load approximately 70 different advertising networks. So the New Yorker takes every visitor and appends a little bit of data about it and then sells it to 70 different publishers, ad networks, who then sell it themselves to other audience amalgamators, other tools to find and serve ads to them. There's a unique sort of challenge with that of if you're running a business like the New Yorker and you're serving content to users and that's the focus of your business, it's hard for them to understand how to monetize someone loading one of their pages.
Well, right, because isn't the ad model actually, for them, it's if somebody clicks on an ad in one of their pages, correct?
Yes, that's right. Thank you for explaining it that way, where currently publishers only get paid for advertising clicks. So instead of when that page loads, and the 70 different pixels send a little bit of your user data out into the world with a fractional penny of value, the publishers never see that money back. And so a publisher is acting sort of like a sharecropper for the data exchanges, where they have the users going to their properties, their businesses, and because publishers haven't had a formula or a process to ask for that money back, they basically have had to play into this sort of game that advertisers have created where advertisers have said, we're only going to pay you when someone clicks on one of your banner ads.
Right. So I guess one of the, like, I just want to back up a teeny bit because one of the truisms that people are talking about, I mean, VCs aren't funding ad plays anymore. And one of the reasons is because we have this duopoly of Facebook and Google really sucking up all of the ad revenue, that the amount of clicks that a company like the New Yorker is going to get is so minimal, so that the massive amounts of money is actually going Facebook and Google. But you actually have suggested that it's worse than a duopoly. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Definitely. So a duopoly would allude to some sort of way to work with both of them at the same time.
So you could play one off against the other.
Exactly. And their Google's DoubleClick data and some of Facebook's data, there used to be processes to basically stitch the data together so that you could see if a user saw a Facebook ad and a Google ad. Well, GDPR just destroyed that. Mm-hmm. So basically, about a month ago or so, Google said, no longer will we allow the exporting of that data that allows for cross between Facebook and Google, that cross-pollination and tracking. And so now, even more so, the Facebook advertising data is walled off from any of that Google data. So you no longer can track if one person saw your ad on both networks with any degree of certainty.
Right. So beyond having these sticky products, which people don't leave, but, you know, I'm sitting in my Facebook world, or I'm sitting on YouTube, what have, and also not sharing the data between the two networks, or between the two platforms, what have Facebook and Google done that gives them, I mean, is this power insurmountable? I mean, you've come up with an idea. We're all driving towards this way that you have an idea that's going to disrupt this. But the big question is, are you tilting at a windmill? These companies are so enormous. I mean, Facebook's market cap dwarfs the AT&T Time Warner merger. So what's going on there?
Yeah, and really what's given them the most power is the quality of their audiences, the quality of their lookalike audiences. So one thing that both Facebook and Google understood really early was they understood that their advertising network, the quality of it, would be judged by the effectiveness of those ads compared to other networks. So very early on, Facebook in particular started to do the conversion pixels, and they invested huge amounts of money to train marketers on how to use the pixels. And they dropped the like buttons and various tools that improve their attribution tracking. And by improving the attribution tracking of both Facebook and Google, it allowed them to improve the advertising targeting. And so there's been a series of land grabs that both of these companies have done that can be reversed just as easily as it was implemented. And so what's kind of exciting about this is data after about 9 to 12 months is totally worthless. So an example, The New Yorker, if The New Yorker were to pull 100% of their data of Facebook code from their website and do a little bit of due diligence to ensure there's no other audience companies that sell to Facebook, they then, in 6 to 12 months, Facebook would have no idea what was occurring on that website. So basically, publishers can play Facebook against Google. They can play Amazon against Facebook and Google. You can play one after the other because they've all created their own walled gardens now. So the fact that they've created, and GDPR has sort of forced them to make the walls even higher, it's facilitating finally partnering with one of the three major companies, Amazon, Facebook, or Google, and you as a publisher can basically create a negotiation where I guarantee you if a New Yorker or another publisher pulls one of those three pixels from their platform, they will soon enough get calls and very interesting proposals trying to get them to put that pixel back.
Well, I guess I'm going to push back on that a little bit because I don't know how important any one publisher. I mean, I think this is sort of when you think about unionization and you know, sort of David and Goliath, I don't know how effective one publisher, unless they band together and then you get weird antitrust issues, has. And so I guess the thing, what happened, my clients are entertainment companies and they have content that helped grow these platforms. I mean, they're not selling brands, they're selling entertainment. People like this content. They're hand raisers. They stand up and say, yeah, I like this page. I really want to see this content. And all was lovely. And then all of a sudden, the organic reach started being throttled. And my clients were like, hey, Facebook, what's going on here? And it was one of my clients was actually told, you've been squatting and now you need to pay rent, which is very rich when you think about what this content company has actually done, what a lot of these news outlets, all sorts of people, if you know, on their backs, these platforms were grown. So my question is, and I guess the big idea that we're tracking toward is it possible to create an ecosystem where I, as a publisher, don't have to play Amazon against Google against Facebook, but I basically can, all of this digital exhaust that I'm sucking up will pay me dividends and returns.
Yep, that's exactly the practical problem. So you hit right the nail on the head that no one is as big as the biggest players. Who wants to be the first to jump under the train tracks? It obviously, and the kind of exciting part is there's someone called the IAB, and the IAB is an international advertising standardization entity that is in multiple countries, but they have a very strong force in Europe. And the IAB is the standardization for the consent management platforms that have rolled out from GDPR. So many of the advertisers or publishers who work in Europe and the rest of the public have been seeing these pop-ups and the do you consent to privacy, the all those cookie agreements. So what's exciting about all of those, beyond the fact that they're a little bit annoying right now in the public, there's a little bit of a backlash, there is a standardization of that data framework that has been implemented. And that is basically an industry that didn't exist a year ago. So the term consent management platform didn't exist. It's a concept that is probably a little bit foreign. And what it is, it's when that pop-up comes and says, do you accept these cookies? The requirements under IAB are very specific, where you have to be able to see all the advertising networks that the data is being sent to. You have to be able to turn off certain ones. You have to be able to revoke consent after you've given it. And so if you look at any of those pop-ups now, instead of just clicking that accept or deny, click that more options or whatever the little, they will almost all have this. Click that extra button. You'll start to see actually this future of the internet that's being worked on right now. And we're actually in the middle, and this will potentially be published after this period, but the IAB is working on something called ID level data transparency standards. And they've come up with 1,300 ways to describe every audience shared on the internet.
Only 1,300.
Well, it's actually, that's right around the number that Facebook has, which is okay. Interesting. And Facebook is currently not a part of this process, but Google is.
Oh, that is interesting.
So there is, and when you look at the publishers that are involved and the advertising networks, it's all of the major audience amalgamators, mm-hmm. all of the major retargeting, the ad roles, the perfect audiences, they're all partners in this. And so in about a month, in mid-July, it's going to be finalized. And then over the coming months, this is going to be rolled out so that every single publisher that's a part of this, when a visitor goes to a website, they will start to be described in a standardized way.
Do you anticipate, because obviously us poor sad sacks in the United States who just are going to be relentlessly tracked and advertised to without our consent, do you think just for ease of use that these audience descriptors will become standardized globally, even here?
They are.
They are. Okay.
Yeah, and that's the exciting part. So basically, the organizations that are a part of this ID level standards process are 50% American or more.
Okay.
US based. And they have a list of the 60 or 70 advertising networks that are involved. And it's the who's who of every ad network you've heard of, except most interestingly, Amazon appeared not to be on that list yet, and Facebook. But Google has representatives, and Google made an announcement a couple weeks ago that they were finally allowing more than their cap of 12 consent management platforms to share data. And that was sort of an odd news, and a lot of people weren't exactly sure what that meant. That's basically Google saying, we're going to adopt the IAB data transparency standards. we're going to be able to share data with anyone who adopts these standards. So basically what that means is if a publisher adopts these IAB data transparency standards for their own marketing, they're going to be able to be a part of finally a different market with all these people using the same naming conventions.
So let's, again, just in order to understand the concept, there are a couple of sort of building block concepts that we need to get down for all the listeners. And the first one is currently, in a very simplistic way, how the revenue flows. So first, let's talk about our New Yorker example. This is outside the Facebook, Google world. I'm a user. I visit the New Yorker. What happens?
A user will go to the New Yorker's website, and when that page loads, their data is being sent to about 70 different companies. So the New Yorker has decided to install these JavaScript snippets on their website so that the data of that user is passed to other advertising exchanges.
Like, for example, like just to, again, super simplify it, this is a person who likes current events, deep, like well-written news stories or something like that.
That's a good example. So a visitor goes to one of the New Yorker politics articles, and it's about welfare in America, let's say. That user reads the entire article, and the New Yorker has metadata on that page that indicates this is about healthcare, this is about maybe a poverty issue, this is about United States politics. Those three pieces of data are valuable to all these advertisers. So it takes your ID or a cookie, and it will basically append those three pieces of data to it, and then it pushes it out into the advertising world. And those 70 different advertising networks will take those pieces of data, put it into their algorithms to determine potential ads or ad matches. And if they have advertisers buying ads that align with those audience properties that were just submitted into the network, you'll start seeing ads from those advertisers.
But doesn't it even get more? So let's say you're on the New Yorker, you've had these three things, but then the next thing you go to is an organic food website, and so you have a little bit more data, and then maybe you look at some fair trade chairs, and so then you become a more complex entity and better targeting, correct?
That's correct. So let's say someone then bounced over to those other sites. They now are someone who has an interest in United States politics, some poverty issue. They are also shopping for chairs. They also happen to be on the East Coast. An advertiser now has a variety of things that they could use to target an ad. And so that user may end up getting an ad that is for a chair company that maybe is a fair trade bamboo chair. So it's a progressive company selling chairs. That's a perfect match for that person, maybe.
Right. And so right now, the revenue model would be, I happen to click on that special fair trade chair, and I'm on a Huffington Post page. The Huffington Post gets 100% of the ad
revenue. That is correct. Yeah. So basically, when you're on that Huffington Post article, an hour, 2 hours later, that totally irrelevant article, you get that ad that says, buy this. You click. A chunk of it goes to the Huffington Post. A chunk goes to that advertising network. And the New Yorker doesn't see a penny. The original chair companies that you were searching for don't see a penny. And basically, all of the data that was provided to these advertising networks, the value just disappears and is taken by other people.
So this then is where the sort of first building block comes up, right? The Shapley formula, is that right?
Yeah, the Shapley value.
Oh, sorry, I pronounced it wrong.
No, I mean, heck, I may be pronouncing it wrong, but it's S-H-A-P-L-E-Y.
Shapley, I think you're right.
So the Shapley value formula is a attribution formula that currently is used by Google. It's used in their data-driven attribution model so that when someone buys something on an e-commerce website, Google will look back across all of the data that, they have, and in AdWords will say, this person came 30% from Facebook, 30% from Google, 10% from your email newsletter, and then 5% from this blog post. And so right now, this Shapley value formula is used to help a marketer shift their budget or their marketing strategies to give more weight to channels or content that convinces someone to take an action. And so it has no monetary value, it just has a strategic value. And so my proposal is to take the Shapley value formula, and instead of just providing insights for marketing optimization, when a publisher or someone who provided the data that led to that eventual advertising click, instead of the advertiser or that publisher just knowing that the data came from it, they actually get a portion of the ad click revenue. And so the Shapley value formula is a formula that's used in hundreds or thousands of financial markets across the world. So Google uses it for online ads, but the Shapley value formula is also used for sharing costs in natural gas transmission lines, electricity, all kinds of public markets where there is a finite commodity that a lot of people have to share, and they also need to share the costs or the value. This formula is used. And so this is a formula that's decades old. There's lots of variations of it. And my proposal is basically just to take the Shapley value formula and start to use it to pay out publishers and content creators for the data they provide advertising markets.
But it's not just that. There's one other piece which is pretty critical, and that is the ETM market.
That's great. And it's basically an exchange-traded fund or an exchange-traded market. So people will see it as an ETF or an ETM, and I'll use ETF for this example, where the exchange-traded fund is a tool and a financial instrument used to basically balance costs and ensure that no one person is paying too much. And so there are 6,000 ETFs or more globally right now. And right now you can trade oil and gas, gold, robot stocks, all kinds of interesting financial instruments. So what's exciting about an ETF is anyone can create an ETF market.
Okay.
And an ETF market, they call them as either active or passive. Okay. Technically, they're all actively managed because even the S&P 500, there's a committee that regularly, about every year or so, is determining whether a company is still in that 500 largest market cap companies. So the S&P 500 is the simplest version of an ETF, where someone said, no one wants to figure out what are the top 500 companies to invest in. We're going to just bundle this so you can easily invest in one thing instead of all 500. And so when you look at something like an oil and gas ETF, there's dozens or hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they're structured is an active ETF, the investment firm or the organization company building them says, our ETF strategy is this. We are going to hold long investments on international oil pipeline manufacturers, and we're going to hold short on international shipping oil companies. So they basically come up with a strategy, explain that to investors, and then create a transparent process to show what assets are in that portfolio. And then they basically allow people to buy and sell that bundling of those assets. And to simplify this a little bit, the ETF market has a balancing effect. And that's the magic behind this market type. And it's why natural gas markets are traded on ETFs, where basically bankers in the market are rewarded for balancing prices. So the example in advertising would be if one advertiser or if one company is paying a dollar per click to target some audience and another company was paying 50 cents because of some special targeting or a cap on their pricing, those two advertisers have no idea that they're bidding differently. And so the person bidding a dollar is overpaying. So an ETF market is basically a transparent bidding process where everyone knows exactly what the last price was, and then the price goes down. And then once someone bids on the lower price that's too low, it goes back up to the normalization. And so there's basically a minute swings back and forth between overpaying and underpaying for an asset. And the market formula of an ETF market automates what the price to buy that asset is so that it's constantly driving it as low as possible.
So in our example, because we're talking about sort of the value, the cookie value, for lack of a better way to describe it, we're talking about creating an ETF for those cookies. Is that right?
That's correct. So what's exciting about an ETF market is it creates automation. And the cookie data that is appended to users currently is inconsistent. But with the new IAB ID level data standards, soon, in several months, any user will be able to be tracked in a similar way to describe that person across most of the internet. And then basically, those properties can be matched to the potential ads to show them. And instead of an advertiser trying to think of the best targeting, the market will be automating the matching of user properties to ad properties based on the market rules.
So will some properties inherently be more valuable than others, right?
Exactly. So if a user has 50 properties appended to their cookie, and they're seeing a series of 10 advertisements that have on average 6 properties being used from that 50 to target, when they click one of those ads, whichever ad they decide to click on, whatever half a dozen properties were used to target could be matched back to their cookie record. Whoever provided those pieces of data could then be paid out for how much each of those pieces of data attributed to the effective targeting.
I see. Well, so sounds fantastic. And as a publisher, I'd be jumping for joy. This is great. What incentive do Facebook or Google have to participate? I mean, or does it take everybody sort of leaping off the cliff and saying, you know what, I'm pulling all my Facebook indicators off?
Fortunately, the incentives are multifold. So the first is an ETF market will always have fees paid by bankers and investment professionals to use the market. And right now, ETF fees go up as high as 14% on some of the financial markets. Mm-hmm. So, and the market cap is trillions of dollars being invested annually in these markets. And so in a new ETF market for cookies, the fees paid by people automating this advertising and basically gambling on the outcome of ads and user properties, mm-hmm. they'll be paying 6 to 10% in fees back into the market that are paid out via the Shapley value formula.
So this is the new revenue that wasn't on the table before.
Exactly. So this is Goldman Sachs paying Facebook hundreds of millions of dollars for the opportunity to trade on advertising targeting.
Fantastic. This also frees, this allows publishers to gain that value from all of that digital exhaust, which they've just been using for marketing purposes, then it becomes actually valuable. And then you're more, the more quality, the more that you attract a highly desirable customer, the more valuable your audience descriptors.
That's exactly right. And the way publishers should think about it is they basically own land right now, but not the mineral rights. And they've had oil wells on their property, and they've been getting a discount at the gas pump, not money from those oil wells. And so this new ETF market will basically allow publishers create new formulas for them to have bankers and Wall Street and investment professionals not only help with the targeting and automation, but those fees come back to them via the Shapley value formula.
Right. So I guess the big question, because my goodness, we're already running through our time, is one, are you building this? Two, what would it take to get it built if you're not?
Short answer, yes, I am building this. And it's exciting because of the IAB framework is facilitating a process where there are consent management platforms that are doing the groundwork right now. So right now there's about 50 consent management platforms that have been approved from the IAB and are currently passing this standardized data across the entire world. Mm-hmm. So out of those 50 companies, there's going to be some winners. There's right. going to be some losers. And some of these folks are understanding their ability to bucket these people and do this automatic targeting. So right now, I'm basically working on collaborating with the existing market players and working on proposing changes or any additional ID standards to facilitate this.
Oh my gosh, it's so exciting, I have to say. It just is really going to revolutionize things and make things so exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm really very excited to be able to talk to someone about this and more folks getting to understand these global standards. And 2018, it really is. GDPR was the first few months of it, and everyone's sort of saying the sky is falling. Advertising will never be the same.
But it's actually what's going to make it work. This is fascinating. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Zach Edwards. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.